Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Media Confidential. Today,
I would just like to say one sentence. This is the most humble day of my life.
That's Rupert Murdoch speaking in front of MPs at the inquiry into phone hacking scandal. 10 years on from the conclusion of the subsequent trials that ended up at the Old Bailey, we're recalling the affair with the journalist who started that story. Nick Davis is here to reflect on the incredible events that led to the closure of the News of the World and the new evidence that is emerging.
It's a story that you'd expect to find in a spy novel. Mobile phones of celebrities and high-profile politicians were hacked. Nearly 31 million emails were deleted. Safes full of hard drives stored in hidden places were uncovered. And Andy Coulson, former Downing Street Director of Communications and editor of the News of the World, ended up behind bars.
This is Media Confidential, your weekly dive behind the headlines and beyond the clickbait of the rapidly moving world of the media with me, Alan Rusbridger.
And me, Lionel Barber. So, Alan, we've an extremely packed show today with Nick Davis joining us to piece together the full, previously untold story behind the phone hacking scandal that rocked Murdoch's News Corp. We're going to get into that very soon, but first, it's time for a quick catch-up. What's been across your news desk this week?
Well, I went to a fascinating talk at the Frontline Club last night in London with the journalist Jen Stout, who has just published a really good book about Ukraine. And it was really about, I mean, it's a fascinating book about Jen herself. She's a young woman from Shetland who comes from a quite a sort of low economic background and has, you know, is very open about the struggles, if you come from her kind of background, of breaking into journalism. But it's also about what it's like to be a freelance covering this dangerous war in the Ukraine. I mean, very mundane things like, you know, trying to get a flak jacket. She can't afford £1,000 to go out and buy a flak jacket new. And yet, if you haven't got a flak jacket, your life is at risk. And she's been doing a lot of work for the Sunday Post in Scotland. It's also a story. She was talking last night about how 10 years ago, 20 years ago, the big Scottish titles would have felt obliged to cover a big war like Ukraine. But of course, we know that the Scotsman and the Herald are not the papers that they were. So, you know, fair dues to the Sunday Post for sending her. And it's also a story, a book, she was talking about it last night, about a different kind of journalism where you're not just going in, smash grab, grab the story and get out. She speaks Russian. She's learning Ukrainian. She's got a much more sort of discursive way of traveling and exploring a country. And it's just a really, it was a really sort of provocative and interesting talk. And the title of Jen's book is Night Train to Odessa, covering the human cost of Russia's war. I really recommend it.
Well, Alan, seeing as you're asking, in my inbox, I can report that the Daily Telegraph Group, including The Spectator, is up for sale again.
Is that news? We knew that, didn't we?
Well, we thought it was coming, because obviously the US, New York, Redbird, IMI, the Abu Dhabi group, that bid was sunk, torpedoed by the government via this new legislation banning foreign ownership of UK news organisations. So Redbird, the Americans, have put up the white flag and said, well, we're ready to sell. We know that the bidders, Daily Mail Group's interested, certainly your friend Paul Marshall, the hedge fund billionaire. The question, though, is that the Americans, Redbird IMI, own the debt owed by the Daily Telegraph Group. It's around £600 million. How are they going to get it back? Well, if they sell the Telegraph titles for more than 600 million, or around 6 million, everything's fine. But what happens if they get a bit less? Here's an interesting little thought. They've indicated that certainly Redbird might like to keep a stake in the Telegraph group in the future arrangements. Now, that is technically allowed, apparently, but it would be quite interesting if you suddenly had a minority shareholder sort of sitting on your balance, on your sheet. So I think this is really worth watching, but long and short, they're being cleaned up for, and Paul Marshall is, I think, is the favorite to win this, because the Mail Group will have problems on competition grounds.
Timescale?
I think in the next 3 or 4 months, they've made clear that uncertainty, prolonged uncertainty, is a problem. Government have said, we don't want to handle it. We're quite happy for the Americans, Abu Dhabi Group, to handle this. And by the way, one of the advisors is the Rain Group in New York, and the other, Roby Walshaw, with a certain former Chancellor, George Osborne, who works there. So he'll be involved still.
He has his fingers in many pies. Well, let's keep an eye on that for future episodes. It was a scandal that led to 7 police inquiries into the interception of communications, into bribery, into the theft of data on behalf of some of Britain's most powerful newspapers, that culminated in the jailing of Andy Coulson. But the story doesn't end there. And that's why Nick Davies has the cover of this month's Prospect magazine. Initially, it was thought there were 8 victims of the illegal activity. In fact, there turned out to be 5,500. And since the trial concluded 10 years ago, hundreds of victims have gone to the civil courts to sue not only Rupert Murdoch's UK company, but also Mirror Group newspapers and Associated Newspapers, which owns the Daily Mail.
Now, with the exception of Prince Harry, in his case last year against Mirror Group newspapers, none of these victims has been able to afford to go to a full trial. But many have been able to persuade the High Court to order disclosure of material from police files and, more importantly, from the inner records of the news organisations. The claimants have now amassed a trove of new evidence, including emails, call data, records of payments to private investigators, agenda notes, minutes of meetings, and recordings of intercepted voicemail messages. Some of this has been deployed in open court. Much of the evidence in relation to the Murdoch papers is due to be deployed at an 8-week trial scheduled for January next year.
We have to say that while 1,600 cases have been settled with the payment of damages, much of this new evidence consists of unproven allegations, simply because the cases haven't gone to full trial. The news organizations contest many of the alleged facts, as well as the inferences on which the claimants are resting their cases. And it's going to fall to the police, possibly, the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, to check the reality of the new evidence, decide whether any of it is strong enough to warrant opening another investigation, and if so, whether it would be right to bring any charges against those alleged to have been involved in unlawful behaviour.
Nick Davies was the investigative journalist at The Guardian who uncovered the scandal. And for the first time, now, 15 years on or so, all the dots are being joined up to form a picture of how the press behaved and also how those with power wield it and consider their actions above the law. Nick is with us now to reflect on the story and recount the new developments.
So, Nick, thank you for joining us today. You broke this story after a lot of work nearly 15 years ago. What made you come back to revisit this story?
I think it begins with a sense of frustration that there is, from a journalist's point of view, a kind of treasure chest of new evidence about the hacking lying around in the High Court. And yet Fleet Street is basically ignoring it. And that particular thing takes you and me right back to the beginning. That you've got this story, which is so important, because it isn't actually about hacking phones. It's about power and the abuse of power and the interference in democratic power. You have this evidence about this important story. And by and large, news organizations ignore it. And that's for a variety of reasons. In some cases, it's because they themselves have been committing the crimes. In some cases, it's political. Right-wing newspapers not wanting to embarrass right-wing corporations. So there's a, you see what I mean? From a reporter's point of view, it's just so frustrating that this stuff's sitting there. I've been retired 7 years and I'm very happy not working, but it just got me to the point where I thought, okay, let's try and pull it together.
So if we start off with the story 2009 that really kicked this all off, it was your story. Can you just remind us how this began?
So initially it begins in a very small way, that the police arrest the News of the World's royal correspondent Clive Goodman and a private investigator, Glenn Mulcair, and accuse them of hacking into the voicemails of people in the royal household. And we were told there was a grand total of 8 victims, 3 in the royal household and 5 other miscellaneous folk. We discovered and ran a big story in The Guardian that this was very, very far from the truth, that the reality was that there were thousands of victims of this voicemail hacking, and that the target spread really across the whole spectrum of public life in this country. And over again, it's important to say this at this point, this was about journalists trying to get inside the private lives, the sex lives of their targets, because slightly jumping ahead here, we can begin to see something very different going on apparently now.
So hundreds, actually nearly 2,000 people have launched legal actions. And that process of discovery, the lawyers getting access to email trails, papers, documents, call logs, is what you've been burrowing through. Just explain, before we get onto what the material says, as a reporter, how do you have to handle this material? Because it's a series of claims and counterclaims, isn't it?
Just to be clear, everybody is aware that Harry is just about the only guy, Prince Harry, who's managed to get a trial. But, and that makes them think, well, that, then the whole process went nowhere. Everybody who sues can get the judge to order the Murdoch company to disclose evidence. The fact that there isn't then a trial doesn't mean the disclosure hasn't taken place. So there's been this steady flow of revelation happening into the court. Yes, then, from a reporter's point of view, we're all allowed to report what happens in court proceedings, but we have to be, quote, fair and accurate in doing that. Otherwise, we could be sued for libel. And there's a kind of good sense in that. If you're accused of murder, but in fact you're innocent, the court needs to give both sides of that a lesson until there's a judgment. So we're careful with the reporting on this to make it clear that we're at the stage of allegation and untested evidence. And where the Murdoch company is concerned, that's still waiting for judgment. With the Mirror Group case, when Prince Harry went all the way, we've actually got a judgment and a conclusion. But with Murdoch, it's untested evidence.
So from your point of view, tell us what the most significant things that you've discovered now.
Okay. So I think what is riveting here is that the disclosure reveals a mass of call data. So these are phone calls which are coming from the Murdoch building into the mobile telephones of politicians. And these calls are very suspicious because they're very short. They last a minute or two or maybe three. This suggests this is not a journalist calling the politician, because if a journalist gets through to a politician, you have a good long conversation. Plus, the journalists who talk to politicians are based in Westminster. These are all coming from the Murdoch building in East London. And what is so interesting is that these mysterious or suspect calls tend to cluster around moments of high political importance. And so it looks as though this may not be about journalism of the most scurrilous kind, trying to discover about people's sex lives. It looks as though it's the gathering of political intelligence. So the possibility clearly now emerges that, distinct from the journalistic operation to hack phones to get stories, somebody somewhere on the commercial side of the Murdoch UK company was using criminal methods to find out what politicians were thinking and doing, because this would enable the company to make more money.
Nick, first of all, congratulations. You are a digger, not the dirty digger of Murdoch fame, but a digger of extraordinary proportion, and over many years, And as you rightly and importantly say, you had to be on the right side of the law. I mean, this is qualified privilege, to use the technical term, regarding the reporting on these court papers. But the second, I want to come to this wider point, the sort of second chapter in the phone hacking story. And you say this is for commercial interest. Can you spell this out? I mean, and particularly bearing in mind there were some important developments. I mean, Sky was, they were looking to buy, take over Sky, number one, and two, of course, the commercial damage by the phone hacking, as originally disclosed by you, was very important.
Okay. Well, actually, let's do it in the chronological order. Let's start with the moment in July 2011 when The Guardian published the Millie Dowler story. And after 2 years of exposure, finally, at that moment, the hacking scandal explodes. The Media Select Committee are already investigating. Their investigation becomes very, very sharp-edged and threatening because they say, we want Rupert Murdoch and James Murdoch to come and give evidence. And you may remember that originally, the Murdoch said, nah, we're too busy for that. So a Labour MP on that committee, Paul Farrelly, submitted a formal motion to the committee that they should not just politely invite the Murdochs, they should summons them and send the sergeant at arms to tell them, you come and answer questions. Okay, so Farrelly puts that motion, and a few days later, the Murdochs agreed to come and give their evidence. What we can see is during those few days when Farrelly is playing that important role, there are 15 suspect hub calls coming through the hub number from the Murdoch building into his mobile phone. So I spoke to Paul Farrelly yesterday. Do you remember any Murdoch journalists calling you that time? No, not a single one. And what are these calls that last a minute or two or three? And understand, there is no question these are coming out of the Murdoch building into that MP's phone. So we have to acknowledge that we're at an early stage with this, but that looks like what you and I might call espionage. The Murdoch crew want to know whether the old man and his son are going to get dragged in front of this committee. And there's another little bit after this, because on July the 19th, the Murdochs duly gave their evidence. The whole thing was disrupted by that ridiculous scene that everybody remembers with the cream pie going into Rupert Murdoch's face. James Murdoch was in deep, deep trouble in his handling of the evidence of that committee. So once again, Paul Farrelly, the Labour MP, led the way within the committee on the question of whether or not to recall James Murdoch. And he was. Guess what happened in the following 4 days? 14 more suspect hub calls going into Paul Farrelly's mobile phone. How do you explain this? So we're not quite entitled to come to a 100% solid conclusion. That looks like political espionage. And there's lots more of it.
But I think you've also just discovered that no fewer than five members of the select committee, so these are elected MPs doing their job of interrogating a powerful company, all have their phones.
It's a bit more than that. On the committee, we can see these suspect hub calls going into five Labour MPs, including Paul Farrelly and Tom Watson, who are very important. The only Plaid Cymru member, Adam Price, the only Lib Dem member, Adrian Sanders, and the chairman, John Whittingdale. So there's some kind of blanket coverage going on here. But just suppose we're right, that these suspect calls really are espionage. It's breathtaking, the arrogance of it, the impunity, the recklessness. I mean, I'm deeply into the whole phone hacking saga. It never occurred to me that anybody in the Murdoch building would be so mad as to do this. This is years after they're supposed to have stopped, let alone targeting the MPs who are investigating you.
Nick, go to the next episode, which you think is important.
Okay. So May 2010, we have an election. Cameron becomes prime minister in a coalition government. A few weeks later, Murdoch announces that he wants to buy the huge chunk of BSkyB that he doesn't already own. There are two politicians who are now really important. Vince Cable, the business secretary, has the job of deciding whether or not to refer that bid to the regulators. Also, Lib Dem MP Norman Lamb.
On antitrust grounds, yeah.
Yeah, and Norman Lamb is the right-hand man to the Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg. He's also, for some of this time, the number two to Vince Cable in the business department. When you, once again, you can see suspect calls going in. So, for example, June the 10th, 2011, James Murdoch's lobbyist, Fred Michel, goes to see Norman Lamb to give him advance notice that they're about to announce this bid. On that day, there are six mysterious hub calls to Vince Cable, the politician who has to decide the outcome of the bid. And over a period of a few days around that visit, five more to Norman Lamb. So I hope this is not too complicated, but you can see the key politicians in what was the biggest deal of Rupert Murdoch's career
at the time
being targeted in a way which clearly suggests that the Murdoch company want to know what they're thinking and saying. And here's a weird thing. Way back in whatever it was, 2012, when Lord Justice Leveson was running his inquiry, he forced various key people in the Murdoch company to disclose text messages and emails. And this enabled us to see James Murdoch's lobbyist, Fred Michel, reporting back to James, texts and emails, masses of them. Now, at that time, I laid them all out, every single text message and every single email, in a chronology and linked it to key events. It's huge. It's 50 pages long. I was rereading it to do the prospect pieces. And in there, there were several times when I wrote to myself in brackets years ago, how the hell does Fred know that? And you look back at those moments. I have done in the piece for Prospect. There are half a dozen moments when you look at what Fred Michel knew. How did he know? I'm not suggesting that Fred Michel is a phone hacker. That's not what the story is here. But if somebody on the commercial side of the company was into phone hacking, they can say to Fred, look, I'm not going to tell you my source, but I have reason to believe that Vince Cable is about to make the following decision. It's really striking. So, and I've laid out these points in the Prospect piece. Again, we're at an early stage with this. We don't really know the final truth. What you can see is a solid foundation for serious suspicion that the Murdoch company was interfering with the heart of our government.
And just to be clear, which particular law were they violating by trying tapping into the phones of Vince Cable or Norman Lamb?
So at the time, the two pieces of legislation were the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, known as REPA, and the Computer Misuse Act. REPA has since been updated. But basically, you're intercepting people's communications.
Okay. And you also refer in your Prospect article to phone hacking, the Attorney General.
Yep. So this is the government's law officer. So after the May 2010 election, coalition government, Dominic Grieve is the Attorney General, the government's law officer. So we can see suspect calls going into him. We've been in touch with him. He's not quite sure why that would have been happening, but it is a fact that he is politically responsible for the Director of Public Prosecutions, who at that time was considering all the evidence that the police had collected in relation to phone hacking. So perhaps they were trying to pick up calls from the DPP to the Attorney General. But I mean, again, it's kind of outrageous.
This is Media Confidential with Alan Rusbridger and me, Lionel Barber. And after the break, we'll have more reflections on the phone hacking scandal.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
In this week's Prospect podcast, Deputy Editor Ellen Halliday is joined by the journalist and writer of Economics and Politics, Will Hutton. If elected, what will a Labour government do to put Britain back on track, if it can?
It's very easy to get very pessimistic about our conjecture. I mean, Britain, there's no doubt about it, since 2010, accentuated since Brexit in 2016, we are living in a country in economic decline. And actually, its standing in the world has fallen remarkably. And it's also a very fractured society. I mean, I should point out that we have 4.3 million kids who report that they go hungry for at least some days every month. You know, we should report that as a result of malnutrition, we have the shortest five-year-olds in Europe. Life expectancy in large parts of the country is actually stagnant and in some parts actually falling. That's the first thing that's happened since the Industrial Revolution. So this economic kind of balance sheet is tipping over into a social balance sheet. Why do I say the glass is half full? A lot of this is the consequence of actually catastrophic decision-making by a political party in thrall to a philosophy and ideas that are just 100% wrong. They have not accepted a role for public agency. They've not built up in economic institutions that could kind of marshal resource and marshal investment. They've flipped and flopped. They really don't know what they're doing.
So follow the Prospect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And to read Will Hutton's article in this month's magazine, why not take out a digital subscription to Prospect and enjoy a one-month free trial to our digital content? You'll immediately get full access to rigorously fact-checked, truly independent analysis and perspectives. There's no commitment. You can cancel at any time. So to take advantage of this offer, visit our website or go to your favorite search engine and search for Prospect Magazine Subscription.
And now back to Nick Davis and the phone hacking scandal. So, Nick, just remind listeners, at this time, what was happening in the criminal justice system? There was the famous Rebecca Brooks trial, Andy Coulson. Was this happening around the same time as well?
The big trial starts in October 2013. The evidence that we've got, all this call data, stops around 2011, 2012. That doesn't mean that the activity stops then. It just means that the disclosure by the court has stopped. So we don't quite know what else was going on. I mean, were they hacking the judge? Were they hacking Leveson? I mean,
But to be clear, Nick, at the Brooks trial, none of this was known, correct?
Yeah, as far as I can think, off the top of my head now, every single element of evidence that I've relied on in this long story about the political hacking is new and has come out in the sidelines of this litigation and been roundly ignored by Fleet Street. I feel genuinely shocked by this. I tell you what, it's weird writing about the Murdoch company.
It takes a lot to shock you, Nick.
But this is the thing, is that you discover that you're trapped in a kind of naivety. I thought they stopped hacking voicemail way back at the beginning of the story when the police nicked Clive Goodman and Glenn Mulcair. Of course they'd stop. Not at all. They carried on.
Right the way through the Leveson inquiry, they were still hacking phones.
Yes. So there's another story which Prospect are going to publish soon, which lays out in detail the evidence of how the Murdoch company and the Mirror Group titles carried on hacking regardless of what the fact that they'd been exposed.
So at some point, Nick, and this switches to the other story that you've written for us in the issue of Prospect that is out today and is online. The actor Sienna Miller threatens legal action. And we can now see inside the company what the reaction to that is. Can you describe what happens as the penny drops that they could be the subject to not only civil action, but eventually also criminal action?
So when Sienna Miller started her legal action in September 2010, her lawyer immediately wrote to the Murdoch company and put them on notice. You have to preserve evidence. We can now see, courtesy of the disclosure in court, emails winging around the building saying, we need to delete these emails. Now, they had been talking about deleting some emails for some legitimate reasons to clear their servers. But what they actually do in the days following the letter saying preserve evidence is to delete the first 10 years of the News of the World's criminality. They started in around 1994. They deleted everything up to 2004, which happened to include a great deal of the key evidence that was emerging in relation to Sienna Miller. There was lots of paperwork went missing from the newsroom at that same time and has never been seen again. Computers, including those of the reporters who were named in the Sienna Miller claim, were destroyed. Now, we have to bear in mind here, the Murdoch company say that in relation to every piece of destruction I've just mentioned, there is an innocent explanation. The destruction then continues over the following months as the pressure on the Murdoch company increases. By January 2011, Andy Coulson has been forced to resign from Downing Street, and the police have launched this new inquiry, Operation Wheating.
Yeah, Coulson being the former editor of the News of the World, who then went to work for David Cameron, despite being warned by a certain Guardian editor, actually, that this was a big mistake by Cameron. Carry on, Nick.
Okay. So what is so fascinating is to see that in January 2011, as Scotland Yard launched this new inquiry, the pace of destruction accelerates. And there is a particularly interesting moment on January the 24th. Rupert Murdoch flies into London to take charge of the crisis. We can see this now in internal emails. And on January the 25th, key evidence is passed to the police, which means they're going to launch this new inquiry. That inquiry is launched on January the 26th. What happens that day? The Murdoch company destroyed 11 million more emails. Two more years of evidence were obliterated as the police are starting their new inquiry. And once again, I get that kind of feeling of naivety. How dare you? And they say, oh, no, well, that's just the servers were terribly overloaded that day. I mean, it's astonishing. And then there's this story that kind of fascinates me because we don't quite understand it. Months later, the police arrest Rebecca Brooks and they search her office. This is in July 2011. And she's got a kind of dressing room attached to her office. And there's a, they call it a vanity table in there. And the police move it. And then they notice that in the carpet there's something and they lift it. And there's the door to a safe hidden under the floor. And they open it up and there's laptops and memory sticks and all sorts of interesting stuff in there. And some of it is encrypted. So we still don't quite understand what on earth it was doing there. But if you stand back and listen to the official Murdoch company position, we want to help the police. It isn't clear how helpful it is to the police to hide that stuff in a safe under the floor under a vanity cabinet.
And then there's the story in the story about the missing filing cabinet.
Yeah, this is also quite interesting. So once the police have come in on that raid and done their search, they seal off part of the Murdoch building and put in there 125 items of office furniture of one kind or another, which are used for storing. So it's crates of paperwork, filing cabinets and the like, 125. And that's officially a crime scene and it is secured. Well, some weeks later, they come back and they search all this stuff in detail and they get to the end of the search and they say, right, that's it, all 117. Hang on, there were supposed to be 125. And when they look back, they can see that eight filing cabinets, each filing cabinet with multiple drawers, that they seized from the office of the editor of the News of the World and the then managing editor, have gone missing. And that no outsider has had access to this building. Even within the building, there are very, very few people. There are two named individuals in the court papers who had access to it.
Well, let's be clear, Nick. Who was responsible for ordering the deletion of these emails, or who was overseeing this cleaning up process? And what have you seen in the documents?
Okay, so the overall destruction of evidence, which the Murdoch company say is innocent and justified, is being overseen by James Murdoch and Rebecca Brooks, and is therefore enormously sensitive subject for the company. That particular point about the eight filing cabinets going missing, the two people who were responsible for securing that area were Will Lewis, who was then very senior in the Murdoch company and has now become the publisher of the Washington Post, and his close friend and ally, Simon Greenberg, who actually has died since then. So those names are you could say in the frame, but what we mean by that is that they've got some explaining to do. It's terribly important. I mean, I believe this is not just legal technicality. We're not entitled to say, we know you're guilty, when actually all we know is that there's evidence pointing at you and you're going to have to explain yourself. But James Murdoch, Rebecca Brooks and Will Lewis are in that position. That evidence says you need to explain what the heck you were doing. And the detail here means you're going to have to take that seriously, not some bland PR thing. I should say that last week I got in touch with the Murdoch company in the UK, the most senior person who deals with the press. And I was surprised, actually, that she declined to answer specific questions and recycled a press statement, which they put out a few months ago. So I'm not quite sure how they're going to handle it.
So just to place this in the larger context of these legal actions, 1,600 cases settled so far, estimated £1 billion in costs and damages so far.
That's a billion, beginning with a B, yeah.
A billion, yeah. There's a few hundred still going through the courts, but the pattern is that the Murdoch organisation settles them all in order to avoid court cases being heard. So apart from the amazing work that you've done on this piece, the only chance of all this being aired in open court is the action by Prince Harry. Is that right?
Yes. So Prince Harry and about 40 others are currently involved in a live legal claim, which is due to go to trial in January and is scheduled to last 6 to 8 weeks. So if that trial takes place, you'll actually have witnesses being cross-examined. And crucially, you'd end up with a judgment where a judge says, OK, this stuff is true and that stuff's false. Whether or not that'll happen, I don't know, because there is this quirk in the English legal system that allows, in this case, the Murdoch company to say to anybody who's suing, here's an offer of damages. And if that person turns it down and then is finally offered anything less than the damages that have been offered, they have to pay everybody's costs. And that runs into millions.
Which we've just seen with Hugh Grant settling, yeah.
Yeah. So at the moment, as things stand, there will be a trial involving the Murdoch titles in January, but they may find ways to stop that happening. I don't know.
To your mind, the incredible hostility of the British press to Prince Harry, do you think that is in any way linked to the fact that he is now the biggest threat that all this material might see the light of day in court?
Yeah. I mean, I think the hostility to Harry moved in two phases, didn't it? One, because Harry and Meghan stopped playing the game, you know, didn't bring the baby Archie out to hold up for the photographers. There was a split and the war began. But I do think it's absolutely reasonable to say that because he in turn has declared war on them and he's got a bank account big enough to really follow through on it, that they are frightened by him. And frightened people become aggressive. I mean, aggression is irrational and disgusting. But I'm no royalist, but I feel quite proud of the fact that Prince Harry's standing up to them and it won't back down.
Nick, as you say, both Rebecca Brooks, Will Lewis, James Murdoch, among others, have serious questions to answer, given all the allegations, and we stress they are allegations, in the court papers and the evidence that you've brought to light in the Prospect article. So what happens next in terms of, I mean, will the police look at this, or what discretion do they have? Where are we going to go from here?
This is a very good question, because if democracy worked in the way that we were taught in school, there isn't any doubt the police would start an inquiry and they would pull in key people, question them under caution, and maybe there'd be a prosecution. But democracy doesn't work this way. But, you know, I always say this is a story about power, and we began with the most powerful police force in the country, having a sack full of evidence of criminality by Murdoch journalists and putting it in a cupboard and not acting on it. So this evidence that we've pulled together in Prospect has been available in the public domain in the courts, some of it for years. Some of it only recently was disclosed in March. Well, where's the cop at the door saying, hello, I need to look at this? It's all about power. And I actually think Mark Rowley, the current commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, is showing signs of having a spinal column. You know, he's gotten to fight with government over several things, for which I salute him. But there is no indication at the moment that he wants to get into a fight with the most powerful people. It's not the government, it's the Murdoch lot. We'll see.
The thing that the Leavers Inquiry looked into, which is the relationship between politics and the press and the police and the regulator, all that. And we know that the regulator fell down on its job, the police fell down on its job. The politicians were scared of Murdoch. I mean, aren't we back, really, to the situation where if you're Keir Starmer or, to be frank, Rishi Sunak, you're going into an election soon, there's nothing in it for you to make a fuss about all this stuff?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. To take on the Murdoch company is to ask for a bloody nose. And who asks for that?
Well, Lionel, that was quite the interview. Here is a reporter who's the only one who has undertaken this enormous task of, you know, effectively spreading, as it were, 5,000 documents out on his kitchen table. And working out what was going on at what point with completely forensic skill and avoiding all the legal booby traps. And the story that he's telling, well, it's jaw-dropping, isn't it?
It is breathtaking because he shows very clearly that the phone hacking scandal, and it was such, goes way beyond what we'd kind of assumed, which was this nexus between celebrity, private lives, private investigators in that accessing phones. It's more than that. It's actually about corporate espionage on an industrial scale. Admittedly, they're trying to protect their own interests, but either because they were looking Murdoch organization to buy Sky, get full control, or of course, once the phone hacking inquiry was underway, of course, they wanted to protect their interests, but then accessing the phones of all those members of the committee and then the allegations here. I mean, the Attorney General, for God's sake.
And Gordon Brown.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose the interesting thing is whether MPs will use this moment to do something. I mean, the Millie Dowling moment was really significant. All these people in public life who are having their phones hacked, all that was really significant. I mean, you could argue that this is the most important story of all because it is the people at the heart of a democracy who, the moment they looked as though they were going to threaten the interests of a company, then got hacked themselves.
Indeed, although I also think there is a serious legal issue here. Will the police act upon the mountain of evidence, and again, it's not proven, but to force these very powerful individuals. I mean, Rebecca Rooks, remember, is still running News UK in news operations, Murdoch's operations in the UK. Will Lewis is now the publisher and chief executive of the Washington Post, admittedly outside the country. And then James Murdoch is also outside, but he's, you know, at least are they going to be on, you know, obliged to answer the questions of what on earth was going on between 2009 and 12-ish.
Well, I want to ask you, you were the editor of the Financial Times. You looked at businesses across the spectrum. Is there any other business that you've ever come across where this kind of behavior is imaginable, where criminality was exposed, chief executive steps down, comes back, is reinstated, and has the company as a whole has this kind of impunity, and the regulator, the police, MPs are terrified of it. Is there any other company in the world that would behave like this?
Well, I'm struggling to think, digging deep back in the memory. I mean, I have to say, and I need to be very careful in legal issues here, but this does remind me somewhat of the Wirecard scandal. Comparison is the way in which our own reporter, Dan McCrum, also had to sift through a mountain of computer data which showed the way in which the money was flowing between this German payments company and dodgy overseas companies. And you really had to do a huge amount of work, the kind of work that you were describing Nick Davis has done. That's perhaps a bit of a superficial comparison. But the other thing, of course, is that this company, Wirecard, was considered untouchable, because it was an icon in Germany. And in the same way, slightly for different reasons, Murdoch's business empire here was so powerful. And we know that. We were rivals in the newspaper industry. But, you know, the politicians were intimidated by the Murdoch papers. I mean, you can argue that perhaps Mail as well was in that capacity, not accusing them of phone hacking. But there was a very, very unhealthy relationship between the news industry and politicians.
Which is what the first Leveson inquiry was supposed to looked into, and the second Leveson inquiry was supposed to look more deeply into it. The thing that troubles me a great deal about this story is that very first story we published in 2009, the Murdoch organization, headed by Rebecca Brooks, came out and told barefaced lies. They just denied it all. They said we were deliberately trying to mislead the British public. The police said the same. The regulator said the same. I mean, this is a news organization, for heaven's sake, which is supposed to be asking people to trust it because it believes in journalistic truth. And here we are 15 years later, the same people running the organization, mountains of evidence coming out in the courts. And Nick Davis is really the first journalist who's pulled it all together and said, there's something here that is, on the face of it, really troubling.
Indeed. And obviously, Rebecca Brooks was acquitted in the trial. Some people were surprised by that. So she clearly can't come back to face the same charges. That would be double jeopardy, to use the legal term. But what Nick has done, as you say, is accumulate. He's put together it's a bit like a giant jigsaw puzzle. And when you look at the pieces as set together, it's pretty compelling that there is a case to answer. That's all from Media Confidential. Thank you to Nick for joining us. We'll be back next week. And remember to follow Media Confidential wherever you get your podcasts, and join us next week for more invaluable analysis.
Thank you for listening to Media Confidential, brought to you by Prospect Magazine and Fresh Air. The producer is Martin Points Roberts. If you've got any questions or comments, send them to us at Media Confidential, all one word, at Prospect Magazine, another all one word, .co.uk, or get in touch via X, formerly Twitter. We are at Media Conf Pod.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.